The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. Can you all hear me? Okay, good. My name is Eileen Reed. I'm the Executive Director of the Washington Metropolitan Area Corporate Counsel Association, which is the chapter here in the D.C. metro area, including Montgomery and Prince George's County of Maryland and all of the Commonwealth of Virginia, of the Association of Corporate Counsel, which is where Deborah House is located. My background is that I was an in-house attorney for 5 years at Children's Hospital. That's how I know Ray. Before that, I was an associate at Shaw Pittman here in the district. And so it's my pleasure to be here with you all today and to moderate this panel. We're hoping to give you some insight into what the career path is like to get in-house, if that's where you'd like to go, ultimately, or one of the stops you'd like to make on your career. That's another thing that we want to deal with, is the fact that you don't have to think linearly, that you have to start here and end up there. The door is swinging in all directions now, and the options are pretty limitless. So we'd like to discuss that with you. And then I also would like to tell you a little bit about the WMACA Corporate Scholars Program, which is a summer internship program that our chapter has going on that is open to students from American Law School as well as the other law schools in our area. But first, I would like the panelists to briefly introduce themselves and discuss their career paths. So, Deborah, can I start with you?
Yeah, I don't know if I can do this too briefly. I was just talking about my philosophy of changing jobs every 4 or so years. So I have one of those resumes. It's hard to get on 2 pages. And I think the important thing is how I started. I started here at AU, and I got my first job as a in-house law clerk the summer after my first year through the placement office with what was then General Telephone and Electronics, which included the second largest phone company in the United States and the second largest producer of electrical light bulbs after GE. So I got an opportunity to work in-house starting very early. From there, I went into government practice. From there, I went into private practice at a law firm. I also worked for a government corporation, a Resolution Trust Corporation, which undertook to resolve the SNL crisis and at the time was the largest government contractor, was the third largest government contractor in the United States government. And from there I went to Fannie Mae, which is just up the street, and I was at Fannie Mae for 12 years and had 3 different jobs. And decided I wanted to do something different, and so I went to the Association of Corporate Counsel and said, where should I look now? Thinking they would give me advice about opportunities that were available in-house, and they said, come work for us. So I am now working for a trade association whose members are all in-house counsel, and we provide them with educational opportunities and resources and publications like the docket you'll see up there. And I provide the association with legal advice as well. So that's my history.
Wow. Thank you, Deborah. my history, I class of 78.
First, introduce yourself.
Pardon myself?
Yes.
My name is Alex Izzard, and I'm a class of 78 graduate of the Washington College of Law. During my time here at AU, like probably most or all of you, I clerked for a law firm for 2 years. And that was very instructive because I sort of figured out that the law firm wasn't quite what I was looking for upon graduation. My first job after graduation was with the United States Department of Agriculture in the General Counsel's office. And aside from feeding us all, the farmer that is, my client agency was the Rural Electrification Administration. And what they did, I had no idea when I went for the interview. However, it turns out that they were primarily a corporate transaction practice. They financed the coal-fired and nuclear-generating power stations in America. That's back when we were, in fact, building nuke stations. I was there for 4 years, and essentially it was almost like a Wall Street practice. I loved it a lot. But for me, the government wasn't going to be the end-all, be-all career. And after 4 years, I left and went into private practice with a local firm. That was very heavy real estate-oriented, and I worked with a lot of builders and developers and local lenders in the Washington marketplace. After 4 years there, I didn't know I had the same philosophy as Deborah, but honestly, the private practice of law was okay, but it really wasn't something that was getting me excited every day. But I was fortunate enough that one of my clients, close client, made me an offer I couldn't refuse to come in-house. He wanted to build a business, and for me, the opportunity to go in and actually work hands-on and build a business was very, very interesting and attractive. So I succumbed to that and went in-house with a small builder in Maryland. We did very well for about 3.5 years, ran into a credit problem that evidently Deborah helped work out with the RTC, and I had to leave that simply because, we ran out of money. I mean, that's the bottom line. Sometimes when you're in business, not everything works out well. But I was very fortunate because my past skills with both corporate side and real estate landed me a job with a non-utility generator back to the electric side of the business, headquartered in San Francisco, but as the Washington Council, and actually looking for acquisitions up and down the East Coast to site windmills, power plants. After a couple of years there, they were relocating me to Boston. My family would not move. I had to find another job. And it's a challenge sometimes when you're faced with things that aren't of your own control. But I was very fortunate again, and I hooked up with a company called Combined Properties. They've been in Washington for several decades, and essentially what we do is we build, operate, manage, lease, sell, buy retail shopping centers in Washington and in Southern California. I'm Executive Vice President, General Counsel. I've been there over 16 years, so just about 16 years. Never would have thought I would stay there that long.
Hi, I'm Jackie Davis. I'm with Sun Microsystems. Hopefully you know Sun. Hopefully you're not stockholders of Sun at the moment. It's been a depressing week. I will break the trend here because I have not held that many jobs, and nor have I switched every 4 years. I have been at Sun for almost 8 years in the legal department, working in the U.S. and Canada, primarily now also in our services line of business, and I can explain more about that if you want. Before coming to Sun, I was in private practice at a Washington, D.C. law firm, Kroll & Mooring, and I practiced in a couple of different areas but ended up specializing in the communications, intellectual property, antitrust areas. After rotating through a couple of departments within Kroll & Mooring. And I am the interloper. I did not go to American for law school. I went to Stanford, but I have interviewed at American for Kroll & Mooring, coincidentally. I guess that's it. I had a clerkship at Kroll & Mooring after my second year of law school. I also worked for a law firm in Portland, Maine after my first year. And I did an externship with a judge in Philadelphia during my third year of law school. So I saw a couple of different sort of legal offices besides the two I've worked in my professional life.
Good afternoon. My name is Ray Scudlow, and I am currently the Vice President and Chief Legal Officer at the Children's National Medical Center just across town. And I guess my career is a testament to non-linearity, as Eileen said. I actually have an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering and worked as an engineer making rocket propellants and working in the General Motors Research Lab. I went to Georgetown Law School. When I got out of Georgetown Law School, I really thought I wanted to do the law firm thing, and I did. I joined a small law firm that had a financially related practice, which split apart, and then I joined a firm that was then called Werner Lipford. They've since merged into DLA Piper. And there I continued to do bank regulatory and deals, just business deals. When I was a father with two young sons, I was hit up by a client of mine who was the president of one of the banks in town, who was on the board of Children's Hospital, and asked me if I would make a donation. I said, sure, but I'll tell you what, I just made partner at Werner Lipford, and I think I'd like to get involved in some civic activity, and I'd like to get involved. And he said, okay. And the next thing I knew, I was on the board there. Now, I continued my legal career. I left Werner Lipford in 78 and joined Weil, Gotshal & Manges as a lateral partner and was doing a lot of interesting things. But really, some of the most interesting things I was doing, and I was having the most fun, was as a board member. And I kept not being able to say no when they asked me to chair this, that, or the other committee. So in the course of that kind of side career, I was chairman of the finance committee, chairman of the audit committee, and even chairman of the board. And while I was chairman of the board, the then CEO resigned, and I had to lead a search committee to find a new CEO. And that was in the mid-90s. I continued to have a good time at Weil Gotshal. I was working in doing a lot of work in the emerging economies in Central Europe. Spent a lot of time in Poland and Hungary doing business deals there. And 6.5 years ago or so, the CEO of Children said, you know, we really want to revamp the legal department. Would you like to come in-house to be chief legal officer? And since I always considered that to be the best job in town, I said yes. And that's what I've been doing for the last 6.5 years.
So you can see we have a good variety on the panel. I do apologize. Two of our panelists were unable to come today. Bob Bostrom from Freddie Mac had to meet with regulators. We said we understand the paying job has to come first. And Sarah Hutchins from Sprint and Excel had some health issues and apologizes profusely. But you can see that we have a variety of folks and backgrounds on the panel, for-profit, non-profit, different industries represented. And that's really one of the things to keep in mind about in-house practice is that you can probably find anything that you're looking for. Just out of curiosity, how many folks in the audience are 1Ls? Hands. Oh my gosh. Terrific. 2Ls and 3Ls. Okay. So and the other thing I wanted to say is that if you have questions as we go along, you don't have to hold them to the end. I'm a pretty informal person, or I try to be. So if you have a question, just put your hand up and we'll ask the panel, or you want to follow up on something that somebody said. I think it might be helpful for you all to discuss the sizes of your departments and how they're structured so that people can get an idea. Because Deborah, having come from Fannie Mae, that's a very large department. I know from personal experience that RAISE is relatively small. So can you give us a little bit of that idea of how things work in a big department where there's probably more specialization versus a smaller department where there's more general practice? Who wants to start? Alex, how about you start this
time? Sure, thanks. Combined Properties has 3 attorneys, myself as general counsel, an assistant general counsel, and then senior counsel. So we're small. In fact, as far as a company goes, we only have 82 employees, about 58 here on the East Coast and the balance in Beverly Hills. All the lawyers are located here on the East Coast. Size and what else? Revenues and things like that, just so you know what you're doing. You do about 9 figures a year in terms of revenues for the company. But being very small, that affords you access. There's not a lot of formality, for instance. The clients are right next door. In fact, they don't want to be called clients because we're all integrated onto the business team. I report to the president and the chairman. We're privately held, so I don't have some of the issues perhaps that others have. And it allows for a pretty effective operation in terms of communication. So a small company, privately held, small law firm.
Jackie? So I may be at the other extreme. Sun has 35,000 employees. We just announced another planned acquisition. So it changes daily. And the legal department, I couldn't even tell you the exact number of lawyers we have today, lawyers and non-lawyers in the legal department, because one of the things about Sun is there are non-lawyers performing legal and compliance functions in the legal department. Our department is actually called the Legal and Compliance Organization, but it's somewhere between 200 and 300 lawyers, lawyers and non-lawyer compliance folks right now. I think one of the interesting things about working at Sun is that it has been remarkably unstructured and unorganized for such a big company. And so one of the challenges after the first 20 years of the company, kind of moving in our growing up stage, is actually getting organization, getting processes in place, managing communication issues when you have such a large organization. So I am part of the sales and services legal group. That means our client base is the global sales force and the global service delivery organization that provides. So we sell computer servers, we sell software, we sell storage equipment, and we basically focus on computer network infrastructure. So we're selling product, and we do it all over the world. And the portion of the legal department I'm in supports that sales activity. We have, I think, 100 or so attorneys in my group across the globe. And we are more or less generalists in my group because the concentration of business is in the U.S., about 50%. The rest is spread around the globe. But folks in the non-U.S. offices are effectively general counsels in their territories. So they need to be familiar with labor and employment law, with general commercial issues, with intellectual property law, pretty much everything under the sun. And then they have resources back at the corporate headquarters for some of the specializations as they need support, or we rely on outside counsel for expertise. In the U.S., it's a little bit different because we have a lot of that expertise within our corporate headquarters because it's U.S. law. So I don't need to be quite the generalist that some of my peers do outside the U.S., but still more or less what I am is the frontline lawyer for what's going on in our field sales organization. Then we also have departments within Sun that focus on narrow areas. So we have a labor and employment department. We have an intellectual property department. Right, yes. We have a corporate law department, and those are much more specialized areas, and the lawyers who work in those areas and the paralegals and other legal professionals have a much more specialized base of knowledge. So we're a bit of a mix, I think, when you compare us to maybe some of the other folks on the panel. We have kind of both models, very specialized lawyers, very non-specialized, and there's a lot of different career paths and backgrounds for people who have come into Sun. So stop there.
And where is your general counsel located?
A general counsel is in California, and that's where our corporate headquarters is located. I'd say probably 60% or so of our lawyers are in California, but not in the same building. So Sun also has very much a diversified workforce philosophy and flexible workspace, I guess that's what we call it, iWork. So even though people are in California in the Bay Area, when you walk down the halls of sort of the legal department part of the building, you may see 20, 30 people. The other 100 people are working from home or working from various satellite offices. So one of the skill sets you absolutely have to have is remote work and remote collaboration. So I work with a lot of different lawyers in other offices or clients. My clients aren't co-located with me. So phone skills, being able to work remotely and work collaboratively with people spread across the globe turns out to be real critical. So underlying technologies, your own work style, everything has to adapt to that environment. Some people do it really well, and some people, you know, really struggle with that.
I'm not going to preempt you, but I want to say that when I went in-house at Children's 15 years ago, we had a general counsel. We had an attorney who had been doing contracts and labor and employment, didn't want to continue doing that, wanted to go part-time. Lo and behold, they found me to do part-time to do employment and labor, and I was very grateful. And then we had an attorney handling the medical malpractice. And then we had a professional who did risk management issues along with the attorney that did malpractice. And when I went in-house, the general counsel at the time said, "Are you surprised we have so many lawyers?" And I thought, we are working so hard. How could you get by with fewer? But, you know, like Alex, it's, you know, you may not have a huge organization, actually Children's had thousands of employees, but you know, the work is still there. So what are things like now?
Well, I can echo Jackie's remark about the necessity for remote collaboration, because even though we're nowhere near Sun's size, we're finding that, and let me explain why. We have about 4,500 employees. We employ all of our doctors. We have close to 500 doctors employed we have close to 1,000 nurses, and then the rest support. So that's 4,500 employees. We're actually, the hospital itself, if you've been there, it's on North Capitol Street and Michigan Avenue, out near Catholic University and Trinity. It is, we're landlocked, and when our clinical programs are growing, we have to push everybody that's actually not touching a patient somewhere else. So we have 17 locations now with different clinics, back office, data center, et cetera. So this remote collaboration is becoming something that we've been struggling with for the last 6 years, and it can happen to almost any size organization nowadays. When I came inside 6.5 years ago, we had a person who did the risk management, and that was it. So I've since hired two other lawyers. The responsibility of the general counsel's office is quite broad. It covers the whole organization, which is research, compliance, corporate governance, contracts, leases, real estate, joint ventures, labor and HR, risk management and malpractice, as I mentioned, captive insurance, joint ventures, and it goes on and on. So there really is no issue that we don't wind up touching. We don't have specialists. We're too small for that, but we do have, we like to have our attorneys have a strong suit, not a specialty. So one of the attorneys focuses on risk management, one focuses on the contract and business deal side, and another focuses on compliance, both with respect to research and other facets of compliance. Healthcare, as you might guess, is a very heavily regulated industry, and we need a lot of that. I report to the CEO and attend all of the board meetings. We're in a corporate structure, so we have actually a parent holding company and seven wholly owned subsidiaries. So even though it's not for profit, it's still quite a complex corporate organization.
Deborah? Yeah, I think you're seeing the great diversity of the kinds of places we work at. And if you walk away with anything from this presentation, you should walk away with the notion that if you're looking to work for a corporation, there are all sorts of opportunities. There are all sorts of legal departments. When I was at Fannie Mae, I supervised 15 attorneys. We did about $22 billion worth of business a year, but we worked in a corporation that did $3 trillion worth of business in a year. And so it was, within the legal department, it was very specialized. So you could work for any of the special units within the legal department, and we had, I think, 110 attorneys. But now, being at ACC, I can tell you that 50% of our members, we have about 23,000 members, and 50% of our members work in legal departments that are less than 10 attorneys. Okay, so there are a lot of small legal departments out there, and people tend to be less specialized, more generalists, and as was pointed out, you know, have a specialty area, an expertise, but not be specialized. And then when I first started off working for General Telephone, I think one of the reasons why, as a 1L, I was able to make a break into that company was because it was the Washington office of a large corporation that responded to its regulators. And so they had, you know, a need that initially could be filled by a law clerk, and then as it grew and I got my first job there, could be filled by somebody right outside of law school. Also, one of my jobs at Fannie was in the compliance department. I headed the compliance department before I left, and I want to say I did not have responsibility for accounting. If you've been reading the newspaper articles about Fannie, you'll know they've had lots of accounting issues that have created a big problem with the corporation. But compliance is a grand new opportunity for attorneys. Often compliance departments are within the general counsel's office, and often compliance departments are outside of the general counsel's office, but they're very frequently staffed by attorneys, and another opportunity that you should look at.
I'll echo that. There was a conventional wisdom in the healthcare industry for a long time that compliance should be outside of the general counsel's office. But with the increasing specialization of compliance, the need for compliance to have some clout within the organization, and just the general corporate governance issues that affect not-for-profits almost as much as for-profits, compliance is now inside legal, which is, hadn't been before, and we're seeing that a lot.
I may ask at this point.
Sure.
Sometimes we have professionals who are non-legally trained, or who don't have a JD, let's say, but who are working in compliance. What's the difference between a person like that working in compliance and a lawyer? Like they have the same responsibilities?
Well, you know, if you've seen one, you've seen one, because I think it would vary all over the place. My compliance officer is not an attorney, but she's been around the hospital long enough so that she knows what the problems are, and she's very tuned into what the regulations are. So it's not nice and neat the way it might be in a law firm where you're either a lawyer, a secretary, or paralegal. In the business area, there's a lot of fuzzy boundaries, I guess. And, you know, in this case, she's under the supervision of attorneys, but it's not necessarily the case in a lot of situations.
Yeah, I would say that we have a number of non-lawyer, non-JD holding professionals in the legal and compliance department. And what they're doing depends on the areas. They have specialized knowledge for the most part. So, for example, in our customs and export control area, we have a number of non-lawyers who are, you know, managing our custom and import-export compliance programs. They do report to an attorney, and it is the attorney who gives the legal advice to the company, but a lot of the day-to-day compliance activities don't necessarily involve the giving of legal advice. Even in our organization, and I say our because I have two colleagues here who work with me, we are in the sales and service area, and we do quite a bit of contract negotiation work, and a number of the folks on our team are not lawyers, but they are contract managers, and that is another specialized area of knowledge. And, you know, we have to be very careful because they have very, very high skill set, many, many years of experience, but technically they can't provide legal advice to the clients. And so when we have an issue that requires, you know, a formal legal opinion, we have to manage that carefully, and they're supervised by lawyers generally in that area. So I think it's going to, you know, to Ray's point, it's going to vary quite a bit by the company and what compliance areas you're dealing with, but healthcare, data privacy, export controls, customs, we have Foreign Corrupt Practices Act issues we have to deal with in terms of anti-corruption and bribery issues when you're a global company, things like that. And business governance, we have a lot of issues with compliance with our own internal policies where we manage some of the day-to-day compliance activities using a staff of non-lawyers who actually do investigations, work with internal audit, report to the board. That one I don't want to think about, but it's amazing how many opportunities there are in the legal and compliance field. Whether or not you're actually practicing law. There's a lot of opportunities for lawyers and non-lawyers in-house.
One thing I would think that's on your minds, you're one L's or two L's or three L's, and you're thinking, okay, how do I position myself? What are the options for in-house careers right out of law school or several years out of law school? Generally, what we've seen is that there are very few opportunities for graduates to move right into an in-house position, that most in-house departments want somebody who's got some seasoning, some experience, some training, usually at a law firm, helps you pay off your law school bills, and then you can start looking. What are you seeing in terms of the years of experience or the skill sets or any particular practice areas that are very valuable for folks who want to move in-house?
I'll start. Well, from the small corporate department and the small company department, on overhead,
So everyone in the law department is overhead. And particularly in a small business, you have to, they're not going to spend money unless there's a core competency, a core value, which is being achieved by the lawyer, by the law firm. So for us, to echo what has been said, you know, the opportunities right out of law school are slim and none, honestly. Because when we hire someone in the law department, we need them to hit the ground running. And so we hire for our core competencies for our company. And each company is different. So depending, and you've heard a wide range of disciplines that you hear from each of the companies. So if some, whatever interests you, you have to find those companies for which that is a core competency. For us, real estate, very broad, but things like leasing, dispositions, acquisitions, joint venture, and capital transactions, debt and equity. We also take care of environmental matters because we buy and sell property. HR, employment, very big, even in a small company, because it's a pretty active area of the law for employees who feel that perhaps they haven't been treated just quite right. And we don't worry about things like compliance. And I say we don't worry about it. We're not governed by it.
Speak directly into the
mic. Maybe I should explain. No, seriously. As a private company, we enjoy certain. We don't have quite as many boundaries put on us the statutes from a public side, from a nonprofit side, from a global operations side. Doesn't exist in my world. And I'm very happy about that, if you want to know the truth. No, because if you want to get into it, it's a huge burden on the enterprise. And we are about making money. That is not a money-making proposition. It is required. It's a law. So obviously companies that are subject to it have to abide by it. But it's not something, for instance, we would seek to hire somebody who is strong in compliance. I don't care. We do observe formality. So one of the core competencies for my group is knowing what you have to do in order to protect the LLCs, the LPs, and the corporations. We have close to 200 entities because of our structures and how we hold our properties, and those require a lot of care and feeding. So these, again, trying to just identify if you're interested in a particular area, you have to align yourself with a company that has those as core competencies and would seek to hire you after you have some experience.
Although I do think that there are law clerk positions out there working with companies, and it's a good experience to have on your resume, both because ultimately when you look for an in-house position, you will have had an in-house position even as a law clerk. And if you look for a law firm position, you know, law firms service corporations largely. And so the fact that you've worked inside a corporation and know how it works, you know, is advantageous to go to the law firm. I almost always hired out of law firms and out of the government. And so there are different ways you can go to get that core experience that are very interesting. But you know, also take opportunities if you can get them to get the in-house experience.
Excuse me, I would echo that. My last hire was an attorney who had 4 years of experience, actually transferred from Arizona with this mid-sized Midwestern firm. Very strong in leasing, so obviously that was very attractive. And the other key part is, and so I looked to hire out of law firms, and I've done that in two different times. And the other key thing is obviously there has to be fit, particularly in a small company, the suitability of the employee to get into the culture and survive in the environment and sort of, you know, get it quickly is extremely important, as well as the pedigree and experience.
So I would say Sun's philosophy has changed a little bit on this in recent years. So, you know, when I started at Sun, the stock price peaked and has been going down ever since. And so, it wasn't me, I promise. That's right. It's not my retirement. So the hiring of folks right out of school on all department levels sort of stopped. We had a really robust what we called Bob program where we were hiring engineers right out of school, doing a lot of recruiting at universities. Was really robust when I started at Sun, and it sort of dried up. And for about 5 years, we did very little. And it's all about budgets. We were retrenching, cutting back as the business was stabilizing. And, You know, and that was the first thing to go. You know, the business has been doing great at Sun for the last 9 quarters. It's a quarter-by-quarter business, as a lot of high-tech companies are. And so we've started to see these things open up again. So I work with the service business unit, and they've started their college recruiting again, and they're on campus, and they're meeting with engineers and recruiting people to Sun. And we've done the same thing in the legal department. Right now, it's been primarily focused in California, but we have a pretty robust intern program for law students to work at Sun during the school year and then carry over into the summer. We do have summer interns. Again, it's primarily in California right now, but, you know, it's a year-to-year thing. As we get budget, we look to expand it. And for many years, it seemed the trend was to only hire people with 5 to 10 years' experience into the Sun legal department. You know, our GC's philosophy has changed, and we've restructured such that we have a what we call it's called the Global Law Network. It is a group within the legal department that actually services the other groups within legal. So we have skimmed off what we consider lower risk, higher volume, lower skill level work, and assigned it to this group. So they almost are like a service organization for the other legal departments. And it's staffed primarily with either junior lawyers, lawyers right out of law school, or sort of mid-level contract professionals. So it's not all lawyers, and it's certainly not senior lawyers. And the idea is we create a career path within Sun, within the legal department. So we train people right out of law school, and then they in this group, and then they move into the other departments within Sun. And there's a real emphasis and support for rotation at Sun. So sort of your family willing and the business supporting, there's a lot of rotation across departments. And the idea is people start their career at Sun and they like it, and instead of changing jobs by going somewhere else, you change jobs within Sun and you can move around different departments, you know, and you can settle in or not. You can keep moving and have a horizontal career at Sun. And, you know, it remains to be seen how successful this is. Like I said, it's a fairly recent development the last couple of years. And it's very challenging because Sun is a very big company. It's a very complex business. And so creating a program that supports these new lawyers so they can be successful and grow into more mid-level and senior lawyers within the department, now that's the big challenge, but something we're working on. So there's actually opportunity right out of law school to come in-house. And I suspect that's true. You'll find other companies out there who do that. It may not be the norm, but it is out there. And either
it seems to me it would be more common in the tech sector, which is a little bit more risk-taking than some of the other sectors.
Yeah, I have encountered it before, Sun, and I've talked to some friends, some colleagues, you know, or some peers at other companies. I haven't seen quite the emphasis on creating this career path within Sun, right out within the legal department, right out of law school. But you know, Mike is brilliant, but he's probably not the only brilliant person out there. So there's going to be other GCs who may be trying to do this because it's a way to train your staff and train them in the way you want them to turn out. You know, for you, 5 years into their career, 10 years into their career. And support the company, and it's a heck of a lot to learn. I'd say the hardest thing I have to do in my job is find talent and train talent. It takes a tremendous amount of time because there's so much to learn, and once you find a great person and you've trained them, you don't want them to leave. You want them to stay. And so I think that's part of the impetus. The turnover costs are so high. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think being a part of a small law department, I think it's true that the smaller the department, the less likely they are to hire someone straight out of law school. But if I were sitting on that side of the table, I'd be thinking, well, what do I do? You know, follow your interests and develop skills and get some training. And you can figure out how to do that, whether it's at a Sun inside in a big organization or with a law firm. And the other thing, though, that's going to help you, I mean, if you're sitting here, you're interested in business, because in-house counsel tends to be business-oriented, whether it's not-for-profit or otherwise. So you're interested in business. And that implies a whole range of skills beyond just writing a brief, believe me. And so you want to have some balance. So even if you're in a law firm, get involved in a not-for-profit. That was a great thing for me. It was very personally satisfying, and look where I am. But it's amazing. If you're a lawyer in a law firm and you think you're advising a client, you think you're giving sound advice, and you think you're explaining something, you never really know unless you're sitting on the other side of the table, you're on a board of a not-for-profit, and you're listening to a lawyer explain something, and you have to make a business decision. You have to understand something, and the scales will fall from your eyes. And that's great. That's great, because if you know that and you're then an attorney on the outside, you can talk to the person who's your client and who's going to pay your bill, and you can become more effective. And as you become more effective and learn those skills, you can then be more effective as a board member if you're in that role, or you can even become more effective and more attractive to someone who is looking to hire someone to be in-house, because you've been there and done that. You've seen it. You understand it. So while it is probably more difficult to get into a small legal department right out of law school, it is a tremendous, not an end game, certainly, but it is a tremendous goal that you can achieve with a little bit of thought, forethought, and activity in the first couple years right out of law school.
One thing that I've seen in terms of the membership of our chapter, and we have 1,600 attorneys who are members of the chapter at more than 500 private sector organizations, is certain subspecialties, again, as Alex has pointed out, as Ray's pointed out, a small department is unlikely to have specialists. But when you get to a department, 10, 15, 20 attorneys or more, it is more likely to have substantive subspecialties. I see a lot of labor and employment attorneys, more employment law in this area than pure labor, because there aren't, children's accepted, there aren't that many unionized employers in the D.C. metro area, but there are some. I see a lot of IT and IP, because as you know, we do have a pretty robust tech sector here, both in Northern Virginia and in Maryland. Some litigation in-house, not a lot, but I know Freddie Mac has it, for example, Marriott, but a lot of, obviously, people who have backgrounds in corporate transactional contracts. So those are all good core competencies to have if you're interested in being in-house. And they translate also to the smaller in-house departments, because you have to be able to recognize and triage all of those kinds of issues at most companies with small departments. But I think I kind of put the cart before the horse, because I'm assuming that you all are interested in in-house careers at some point, and that you want us to help you understand why they're vastly superior to going or staying at law firms. So I would love for our panelists to kind of compare and contrast what it's like to practice in-house versus what it was like either in the government and or at a law firm.
Well, let me take a stab at it. I was a partner in a law firm for, I was at 13 years at Weil Gotshal and 9 years at Verner's. So I was a partner in a law firm for quite a few years. And I loved it. It really was a tremendous experience, but it's very different. It's very different. I always used to say the nice thing about Weil Gotshal is that it's solely dedicated to increasing the wealth of its partners. And the downside of being at a firm, any law firm, is that it's solely dedicated to increasing the wealth of the firm. So it's really fun being part of an organization, being one of the business managers of the organization, and helping to build something that is worthwhile. And I say that I consider myself very lucky to be at an organization like Children's, but I could say that for really any sound or combined properties or anything. You know, companies do good, and they do it in different ways. They provide value, they provide services. And if they don't, they go out of business. And that's true for not-for-profits as well as for-profits. So you really get to be an integral part of an organization that hopefully endures, and you're part of that. In a law firm, they've become kind of, in an ironic sense, they're more institutional and less institutional. They're more institutional in that they're big, they're corporate, they're kind of run like a business, but they're not organizational in the sense that all of the talent presumably goes home sometimes, and that's the whole organization. So it's constantly morphing, constantly changing, and there really is, even with the biggest and best law firms around, there is this abiding sense of impermanence and just doing a job, just doing a project, and so forth. Now, some of the projects can be very worthwhile. I got to work in the emerging economies in Poland and Hungary. It was a lot of fun, very challenging, and you felt like you're doing some good. But when I finished the project, when we did an IPO for a new telephone company, or when we set up a bank in Poland, that was it. And you kind of move on, and the owners and the employees there got to build the organization. So you'll get tremendous training in a law firm, and you'll really sharpen some skills there, but it is quite different.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of what Ray says. I was not a partner at Kroll & Moore, so my perspective and experience was a little bit different. I had a great experience working as an associate in the law firm, and I learned a tremendous amount. And I think what was really striking for me is, everyone's experience is different at law firms a lot. It depends on who you end up working with and what areas, what cases you get on, what projects. That can really drive your experience. I had a tremendous experience. I had a great mentor, and I learned a tremendous amount. It was fantastic training for being a lawyer, very disciplined. I'm not sure I would have learned, developed the same skills had I gone right in-house out of law school. What's distinctive is how your career path at a law firm is developing a very detailed and deep knowledge of an area of the law. Even, litigation specialists who consider themselves generalists, and they can litigate anything, or at least you'll hear that a lot. They still have a specialized type of knowledge, which is in litigation. You are it. You are the business as a lawyer. Everybody who comes in the door in the morning is there to support you as the money maker for the business. And so the lawyer is the business. In-house, to Alex's point earlier, it's exactly the opposite. The lawyer is overhead. You're always going to have a skinny budget. You're always trying to do more with less. The company doesn't make money off of having a lot of lawyers, so there's a constant pressure to keep legal department costs down, have just enough to be in compliance and to get by and to drive the business. And so the business is not about you as the lawyer, and you're a tag along, and you feel that. And so you do become integrated in the business with your business team, with your business clients, if you're lucky. And a lot of my job satisfaction comes from feeling like a part of that business team and playing my position. I am the legal advisor, and I contribute to the business by paying attention to my areas of expertise and offering that contribution to the business. But I don't have time to delve into legal topics on a day-to-day basis. So I'd say for most things, I shoot for a B-plus job. Like, I get the legal advice out there and I move on. And I got to know when is an important enough issue coming along that I have to do an A-plus job, because it's really significant or there's a high risk to the company. But most of the things that cross my desk every day, I just have to get B+, B minus, maybe C+, because I just have to move on and get the volume through the door so I'm not holding up the business. And that is really different. And I see that when I interact with our outside counsel now, because, gosh darn it, I want an A+ job from them, because I'm relying on them to turn around and give advice to my clients. So your experience as a professional is quite different. I love being in-house because I really enjoy that mixture of law and business and being part of that business team and contributing to an enterprise. I had a great time at a law firm, and I wouldn't do it differently, but I have found my home kind of as a professional in-house.
I would pick off where Jackie left off. I love my job. I have the best job here. I don't care what Raymond says. But if you feel that way about your job, you'll stay there for quite a long time and may explain why 16 years of combined after 4 years, 4 years, 2 years, 2 years kind of thing. But I started out in the feds, as I mentioned, and the reason I to this day love that job. My recollections of that job are great. And primarily it's because I'm sure you've all heard it. You know, you go in the federal government and they just throw you right into the deep end. Day one. And you either swim or, you know, whatever else happens.
Or you don't.
Yeah. But just a brief aside, my first deal when I walked into the Department of Agriculture was to work on the participation agreement to buy an interest into Comanche Peak 1 and 2, two nuke stations down in Texas. And I worked on that deal for a year. I didn't know what I was doing. Honest to God, I did not know what I was doing. It didn't really matter, okay, because it's the way the government works in many of the legal offices, okay? I wasn't trying a capital murder case, fortunately, or anything like that. But when I got to the closing table in Dallas, sitting around this fairly large table with a bunch of attorneys, and I was the youngest person in the room, and we went around the room talking about this deal, and they're saying, well, this is the biggest deal, this most complex deal. And when they got to me, I said, this is my first deal. And that's what the government offered me. It offered me the instant opportunity to take on substantive issues and big-time matters and be responsible for them. And a lot of collegiality in the government practice if you're in the right office, and if you're in an area that really turned you on. And for me, you know, corporate transactions and big deals and participation agreements, I loved it. And so there's nothing wrong with the federal government as a training ground. And today, friends that I started working there, the class of 78, whatever it was, where we all came in, one's general counsel at the Office of Trust Supervision, whatever that place is, another one's the Assistant General Counsel of Banking and Finance at Treasury. They stayed in the feds because they liked it. Others are partners at Skadden and Arps and other firms. But you can get some great training there, and then it's just a question, is it for you or not, and then where do you go from there? Private practice for me was also good training in the sense of now I got a client, now a real client, business client. Whether or not the kind of work I do, A-plus work, is going to matter a lot to that person. And the deal goes through, get it or not get it, matters a lot to the business side. And what I picked up there, which I really didn't get in the government, was a sense of business. And to me, that also was extremely invigorating and motivating. And so when the client, after about 4 years, made me an offer I couldn't refuse to go in-house as his first lawyer and in a business setting, I jumped at it. It didn't turn out as I had hoped it would, but in terms of, you know, what happened to the firm, but it was a great learning for the business side because, as Ray and Jackie are saying, you have to have some business acumen. You have to get it with the business. You have to understand. You cannot just be the lawyer and say, well, that's a business issue. I'm the lawyer. I'm going to give you legal advice. Because your coworkers don't appreciate that. They don't make that distinction at all. And so you have to integrate yourself into whoever you're working with on the business side and be their partner and help them get it done. And you either like that or you don't. You either like being the senior partner at a worldwide law firm, enjoying all the benefits of that, or like being in a business environment. And then I'll shut up in just a moment. One final thing, big difference, and one of the things that I really do enjoy about government practice as opposed to the law firm practice, when it's Friday night, there's a huge difference whether you're placing the call for the work or you're receiving the call. Right? You're laughing and choke about it, but that is a huge, huge difference. And I have no problem placing the call at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and telling outside counsel when I need something and hanging up. and going to do more work because, honestly, you know, one of my hours, I get to work around 7:15 in the morning. I leave around 7 o'clock at night. So a lot of times we hear, well, going in-house and you enjoy it because it's not, you don't work as hard. You'll put the hours in. You absolutely will put the hours in. And you'll have to reschedule your vacations and do all that trash. But that's part of being a lawyer. Right? You know, it just comes with wherever you are.
Although I would add, I agree with everything Alex said. One of the things that I don't miss is keeping track of billable hours.
Yeah. That's the elephant in the room.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, you do work just as hard. I find it more fun because by not looking at the hours, you focus on the task at hand and how to get it done most efficiently, come up with the most creative solution, and so forth. So I don't miss that at all.
I would tell you, though, at Sun, we recently started tracking our work. And it's not to the level of reporting your hours to the quarter hour or the 10, you know, the 10-minute or 6-minute increment. But the reason we started doing it is, you know, the legal department's a cost center, and we have to justify our existence to the business. And one of the reasons our general counsel wanted this information is he needed data. He needed, we use it for a couple of different, in a couple of different ways. One is to demonstrate what it is we do. Another is to identify trends in the business and what we're supporting and to plan for the future. So if you look at my job and you see that I'm spending 80% of my time supporting transactions, you know, 10% of my time training my clients and 10% doing something else. And the general counsel says to me, well, if you spent more time training your clients, could you rebalance and spend less time doing transactions? Can you empower your clients to handle some of these issues? And then we could take your time and focus it in this riskier area. And the answer is yes. But unless you have the data on how your legal department is spending its time, you can't really make those decisions and make those investments where the company is struggling or where we have bigger risks or even plan for the future. So, you know, the 22nd century legal department. And there was a lot of resistance within the department to doing this because we have a lot of people with law firm experience who said, I love the law firm so I didn't have to track my time. But it's a lot less detailed, so it's not that burdensome, but it's incredibly valuable. And the bigger your department and the more planning type activities you have to do like that, the more pressure you'll see to do some of these traditional time tracking activities for just purely legal management purposes. And the other thing I'd add is I work just as hard or harder than I did when I was in private practice. It's just different. Ray made a great point. I work towards objectives, not about the time. And I work when I need to work, so I have a lot more flexibility. So we had a request come in last night for a deal that we'd never even heard about. And, oh, by the way, we need to close it today. It's like, you know, couldn't you have told me this, you know, 2 weeks ago when you started it? You know, so you still get that. That it's the nature of being a lawyer, and you're supporting the business, and you work when you need to work. But when it's quiet, you know, over Christmas, I don't go into the office. You know, there's no FaceTime. It's a different kind of culture. Probably different departments are different in that respect, and same with law firms or government agencies. But my experience is I have a lot more flexibility. I work very hard, but it's more flexible, and it's much more focused on the objective.
There's sort of two points I would add, and I echo a lot of things, particularly the value of government practice here. But two points I would add is one thing that happens to you in a law firm is it's not just keeping your hours, it's the marketing. I remember being an associate, and I was so excited about making partner, and then all of a sudden, oh, my God, I've got to do this work and market myself. Mm-hmm. So that was an additional burden, and, you know, some people like doing that, some people don't, but I think you need to look at yourself and ask you know, where do you fall in that? The second thing is in-house, you can really see some of the results of your work. And we did all these real estate transactions at Fannie, and I used to tell my people, take the money, take the time, and go see the property you just closed, because this is affordable housing for people who don't have anywhere to live. And you need to know that all these documents that you put together really meant something, you know, to people. So if you can find yourself in an organization where, you know, you're not making the world safe for the war machine, perhaps, and, you know, I say that because I'm a child of the 60s and I never got out of it, but you know, affordable housing, when I worked both at HUD and when I worked at Fannie, I could see the results of my work, and that meant a great deal to me. And to some extent, when I came with the ACC, you know, the mission isn't quite as flowery as affordable housing, but using my skill set to be able to help other in-house counsel was something that really gave me more purpose then I would get just billing hourly on, you know, this job, then this project. And so that really gives you some rewards that you can't get elsewhere.
I would add one thing from my experience, which is that the good outside counsel, and there are very, very many good outside counsel, understand that the lawyer doesn't want to come in and just say, you can't do that. Because that doesn't go over real well with any client. But the in-house counsel really has to understand that. That you can't be the naysayer and the deal killer. Because then the business people won't call you. They'll just do it. And they'll leave you to clean up the mess. You want them instead to engage you as their partner. And so, okay, this is how you'd like, this is the objective you'd like to reach. You know, this is the way you'd like to do it. Well, that has X, Y, and Z risk. Let's look at alternatives so that we can get there in a less risky way. And so, again, you want to be engaged. It's very satisfying to be there and be the one developing the policies and procedures so that your organization can be in compliance with law and to be on that front end. Oftentimes, you know, because outside counsel are so expensive, folks don't call them in until it's turned into a mess. So just little things like that. But it seemed like the panel was getting into a little bit of myth-busting about what in-house counsel is versus outside, and I think that might be useful to talk about briefly. One thing that you all touched on was that it's not 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. Technology has made the work of outside counsel, to me, totally unpalatable. You know, you've got the BlackBerry, and it's 24/7, and you've got these, you know, unreasonable clients who call you at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday and want it the very next day. I'm just kidding, but the expectation is that if you're paying X hundreds of dollars an hour, you can make the demands that you know you want to make because you're paying for the nose for this great service. But in-house counsel are working every bit as hard. Just, you know, differently. So what are some of the other myths? And one of the ones I'd like you to touch on.
Eileen, you have a question up here.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, just on what you've all said so far. Most of you have stressed the importance of developing skills and getting training, whether it be at a firm or in the government, before going in-house. If you start usually as an associate at a firm, particularly at a large firm, you're required to specialize. And it seems like most of the positions available as in-house counsel are more general. And I'm just wondering whether that's a difficult transition and whether there are particular things that you can do to better prepare yourself for that. And then also just what other differences or obstacles you have to overcome by having been in a firm or in the government prior to going in-house.
Well, I would say that if your objective is to go in-house, ultimately, then when you're in the law firm, become a serial specializer, I guess. First and foremost, follow your interest. You know, if you're not really interested in something, don't go near it. But if you're interested in something or something catches your interest, I mean, the flip side of that is you got to be open to other, you know, other things and recognize that when you're in-house, even though there's, you know, four different specialties sitting here in terms of the actual business, a lot of the issues are going to be common to any business. You've got employment, you've got labor, you've got corporate governance, you've got contracts, you've got leases, you've got business transactions. So clearly business transactions would be one area that you might want to look at, but there's litigation. Every company has litigation. So it's really wide open. So follow your interest, and again, only dig and stick with the specialization to the extent that you're happy with it. And you find yourself not happy with it, then do something else.
Yeah, I actually have done recruiting and hiring for Sun, and it really varies because some of the positions are that open up are looking for very specialized skill sets. And so you just have to have the skill set. You have to have the labor and employment background or the corporate background. Or recently we have an initiative to set up joint ventures in various parts of the world. And it didn't really matter where in the world you were located, but if you didn't have that specific joint venture experience, you weren't going to get the job. But there are other positions where, you know, I've interviewed for and hired for where it didn't really matter what specific background you had. You didn't have to have a strong substantive knowledge background. And what I looked for was other kinds of skills. So, you know, when you're hiring for a generalist position, you're going to want them to, the candidate to have at least hit one of the five things that you anticipate that person having to deal with on a daily basis. But you're going to look for other skills like communication skills, business experience, you know, outside, you know, board memberships, just kind of developing that general business acumen depending on the job. And you know, frankly, networking skills, because most of the people I've hired and I got my job myself at some through networking, not through kind of cold applications or cold interviewing. And that's probably the biggest skill you can develop from the get-go, from law school. That's going to serve you well to position you to go in-house because, frankly, I've tried hiring through postings and I've been very unsuccessful. It's been the networking efforts that have led to the greatest success. And I hear that a lot from a lot of colleagues. So, you know, the first thing I do when I have a job posting is I email all my friends who are in-house or at law firms and say, do you know any good candidates?
We run listservs at ACC where we might have 5,000 members on the employment listserv, and all the time it comes up, I'm looking for an employment lawyer and blah, blah, blah. Know anybody? And that's really, you know, how it works.
Well, the way I found my job is that I had been at Shaw Pittman for 5 years. I had had my first child. I really wanted to be part-time in a way that law firms didn't support. And the managing partner in the employment area sent around a memo to all the people in the employment practice area saying, Lee Doty, the GC at Children's, is looking for somebody 3 days a week to do employment law. If you know anyone outside Shaw Pittman who would be interested, please give me their name and resume. I wrote Lee directly. And you know what? It continues to be that way. I know through WMACA we do encourage that kind of networking and you know, sharing of intelligence about jobs. Deborah, would you help us with some of the myths that we can bust about in-house careers, and especially getting back to the point I made earlier about things not being so linear as they had once been perceived, where you could start at a law firm, if you went in-house, you know, that was it. You couldn't move back. You couldn't go from government around. Right. What are you seeing at ACC?
Take a look at my resume. I mean, you know, it shows that there's lots of experience that in-house are looking for. It's not law firm. It's not government. I mean, it depends on what the job is that they're trying to fill. And when we look at people who are members of ACC, they are coming from all walks of life. And I think this goes back to what was said. So you don't say, I want a job there, and so I'm now going to mold myself to fit a job in that arena. You look for what you enjoy, what's good, and then find a job that fits you instead of trying to fit you to the job. So the myths that you need to be law firm to go in-house, you need to be government, you need to be one thing or the other, change. And they can change because of trends in business. And so, again, that's why you go back to doing what interests you and what's going to make you happy and then looking for the job that matches that.
Way back when I started, there may have been a myth, but I don't think it's true today, that if you went in-house, then if you wanted to go back to the law firm where you came from or a different law firm, that route may be foreclosed or it'd be difficult. That's not the case. And I'll tell you, as the general counsel, I have two great lawyers. I live in fear. Not fear, really. But they'll get raided by a law firm because they have such great knowledge and skill sets in their areas. They're very competent. They're excellent, you know, people persons, and a law firm would die to have them. Now, what we offer as a counterbalance is a lifestyle. You know, they can telecommute. They can remote. I got one of my lawyers who spends 6 weeks in South Carolina, 2 weeks this month, and following four in February, second year in a row, where she's working from South Carolina because we allow telecommuting to that extent. But I don't that myth about, you know,
I've lost many of my attorneys to law firms for one reason or the other, and I had offers from law firms before I went to ACC coming out of in-house, and so, you know, I don't think you cut yourself off at all.
What career development, did you have a question?
Is, a minute ago we were talking about decision makers conferring with attorneys about how to best create a strategy. And what I think I have a sense that smaller legal teams will have more of a hand in designing business strategy. Maybe you hear from small groups and large groups about whether you actually do have that decision making.
In my case, absolutely. I mean, in addition to being general counsel, I'm on the executive committee. There's four of us that run the company on the executive committee. I do annual planning. We go off-site to do our annual planning, and we go off-site to do our strategic planning, which is a five-year plan. We do that every year. So in terms of the big picture, what do we want to be in 5 years? What is our goal and objectives? I participate in that. Excuse me. But likewise, the annual plan, where our goal setting is for each calendar year. I have a very large hand in that. And as I think maybe mentioned earlier, you know, one of the things that I think in-house offers is that very opportunity to participate at that level. And as you rise up in a corporation, I'm just going to surmise maybe in a larger corporation, but certainly a smaller corporation, you have a fair amount of control, where I'm not sure you have it all the time in a law firm, even at a partner level, because you know, there's so many partners, and you've got you're widely dispersed. So, from my perspective, a small law firm, that opportunity to participate strategic as well as goal setting is there absolutely.
And I stress that it's an opportunity; it's not a given. If you as an individual don't add value to that high level strategic business planning and so forth, you're not going to be at the table. But the point is that there's certainly an opportunity for that. And if you look across corporate America, there are, you know, I could give you a dozen examples, I'm sure, where the general counsel became the CEO. And so, you know, the opportunity is certainly there. You just need to make sure you get the right skill set, the right level of experience, and the right interpersonal skills, strategic thinking skills, that will allow you to add value to that. Because it's a tough world in the sense that everybody's almost always sitting around the table thinking, how did that person add value to this discussion, et cetera, because the pace is so torrid, really. It's really picked up tremendously since I've been practicing law, that you kind of need to make that decision. And then if you're not adding value, you won't get the phone call for the next year.
Yeah, and I would say being in a big corporate legal department, it's a little bit different. It's the same sorts of things happen, but they happen in a more structured way. So if you look at our general counsel, he reports directly to the CEO, and that might not strike you as odd, but that's actually quite unusual. A lot of times the general counsel will report through the CFO, for example, to the CEO. By reporting directly to the CEO, your general counsel is actually a member of the executive management team. And it means, in our case, he equal player at the management table, making those decisions about the future of the company and the goals. So that filters down through Sun. So that's the position our general counsel is in. But if you look at each layer of the legal department, and we are a pyramid, and that, I'd say that's one of the downsides of being in-house, is most in-house departments that I'm familiar with have a pretty strict pyramid structure. But each of the managers, you know, above me and myself included, we sit on the senior management team for our business partners. And the expectation of a Sun lawyer is that you are providing that business partnering, that business counsel, as well as that legal advice. You are not doing your job if you're just sitting back as the lawyer and offering your little legal tidbits now and then. You're expected to participate, to understand the business, and then have that business partnering relationship and actually act as part of the management team. I don't think that's true at all legal departments. That's something you have to look into. You have to inquire about. If that appeals to you, you have to look for a company that has that culture, because it's not going to be true across the board. But I think quite a few places, that is the expectation, and that's also the opportunity.
And one thing that you might want to look at and seriously consider when you're looking at, you know, where to go in-house is that very culture issue, because you'll find that if you look at the Enrons and some of the other companies that didn't make it ethically and governance-wise, they had a weak general counsel structure. The general counsel was not in the loop for whatever reason. And that tends, and again, the value that you add is that you keep your organization out of trouble by convincing them that they should do the right thing, and they can do the right thing and still have a good business and still make money. That's the real art to it. You can't sit back and say no. You can't say yes if it's the wrong answer. So you've got to come up with, say, yes, you can do this, or no, you can't do it the way you just proposed, but there is a way you can do it, and let me help you figure it out. So that is, if you had to put the value that a lawyer at a business roundtable, the value that a lawyer brings, that's it. So that's your skill set. Just like the structural engineer says, yeah, you need a beam of 3x3 to support this building, you're going to tell them that you need to do this, this, and this to be legally compliant, but if you do it, you're going to have a great deal or a great business.
One of the activities that my organization has been involved in recently is creating educational programs, which basically are designed to teach lawyers what they did not learn in law school, which is to teach them business skills, team management, strategic planning, all of the skills that the panel have been talking about that they need every day, which they've been developing on the job, okay? And so we're going back and saying, you know, we'll give you a 3-day intensive course, a mini MBA or Executive Leadership Institute, when you get some of these additional skills. So if you build those skills, you know, as you build your career, as you are in law school, you think about how things work in reality, not just, you know, what are the requirements of civil procedure, but how does that really affect an organization, then that'll help you along that path right away.
And not to repeat myself or harp on my experience, but I learned a lot of that in my volunteer activities on a board, because you are the business person then, and you have to learn how to get along with your board members and to achieve something and to work together. So I can't really stress enough how valuable you will find any type of pro bono activity, not if you're going to be a litigator forever, you do pro bono and litigation, but if you want to be a business lawyer, the pro bono piece that you want to look at is not-for-profit organizations and get involved there as a volunteer, you know, community leader, eventually board member, and so forth. You really learn a lot of business that you don't learn in law school.
I'd like to talk just briefly with you about the corporate scholars program that WMACA has. And then we'll wind up with the panel. We'll actually end early so that if you all want to come up and ask anybody questions informally, you should feel free. We didn't expect to get out of here before 6, so we'll be making ourselves available. The WMACA chapter got a grant about 4 years ago from the Minority Corporate Counsel Association to create a diversity pipeline program of some kind. And so we decided to create a summer internship program. And it started, this will be our 5th summer. Our first summer we had applicants from all local law schools and placed 7 students. And over the course of the 4 summers that we have done this, we've placed more than 25 students in in-house departments in internship programs. Companies and organizations from Washington Post, Newsweek, Interactive, PBS, Public Broadcasting System. We've had interns at Freddie Mac. You're getting the idea. I mean, for-profit, non-profit, large, small, and all we require of these hosts is that they make sure that the students who come in get a strong, substantive exposure to what it's like to practice law in an in-house department, deal with the business people, get real assignments so you'll have the same product when you get out of one of our internships as you would have from a summer internship, I would hope, at a law firm, where you have a written product that you can use for a writing sample when you're looking for that next job. It's a wonderful opportunity for 1Ls who will be rising 2Ls. It's also a wonderful opportunity for 2Ls who become 3Ls. We've had students do the Corporate Scholars Program. We had one woman who came from Howard. She did the scholars program at Sodexo, which is a food services company located in Gaithersburg. The next summer she was at Skadden Arps in New York. which is a pretty good law firm. And they really appreciated the fact that she had gotten this experience over her 2L summer. We put materials in the back of the room about the scholars program, just a one-page brief synopsis, which has at the bottom the URL on the WMAPA website where we've posted all the materials we have in FAQs, and the application. There are also copies of the application, thank you, Kelly, in the back of the room if you'd be interested. If you have any questions about the program, I'm happy to answer them. On that web page that is referenced on that one pager, I will also be posting an article from ACC about how to go in-house, if that's what you're interested in doing with your career. It's available on the ACC website generally, but I think it might be member password protected. So I'll post it on that website, that web page tonight. So if it's something you're interested in reading, you can access it there. And now, for our last question, I'd like to ask the panelists, what was the best piece of advice that you ever received and followed, and what was the best piece of advice that you received that you didn't follow? Deborah, you get to go first. Unless you're
a pet. I had two really quick ones. They're the same ones. One was treat everybody with dignity. Now, I came out of a law school in an era where women were still proving how tough they could be. So, when I went into litigation, I went into litigation with a chip on my shoulder, and my mentor said, treat everybody with dignity, don't behave badly in depositions and that kind of thing. And another mentor told me, don't be petty, because it makes your life a lot easier if you are in your professional practice, never petty. So that was the best advice that I took, and unfortunately it was the best advice that sometimes I didn't take. And, and I regret that, but I do think it's really good advice.
Well, that's very good. My advice, I'm not sure they were that smart or whatever, but what I recall a long time ago hearing, and it's true, is that the grass is brown everywhere. what that really means, not pessimist, okay, it's definitely a half full scenario, but you have to do due diligence. You're not happy? But why aren't you happy? Okay? Figure it out. And then if you think you need to make a change, do your due diligence before you actually leave. All right? I mean, sometimes you just want to leave for the heck of it. But we have had, I've seen it, almost did it myself, but I've seen it where folks have left our company, for instance, and they, because for whatever reasons, and, 3 months later the call comes, 2 months later, it really wasn't so bad. And so that's something that I heard a long, long time ago, and as I was making my various changes, I always made sure I did it for what I thought were the right reasons. I'm sure I got lots of advice that I ignored. I can't remember what they were, so I don't remember anything. Yeah, sorry.
I have two pieces of advice.
I have advice that I both listened to and ignored at the same time, so I'll share them all. One piece of advice I got from my mentor at the law firm was to specialize in an area. He said you'll be the most marketable if you develop a deep level of knowledge in a particular area of the law. You can build your whole career around that, and besides doing interesting things, that is a wonderful career path for a lawyer. And I've toyed with that over the years I've been out of law school, but I haven't really done it. I'd say at Sun, I'd be considered much more of a generalist, maybe with a specialization in commercial practice, but that's not really a specialization like most lawyers think of it. But I think it's still good advice for lawyers, and for some lawyers it's just not for everyone. So if there is something you love, and I think Raymond made this point earlier, I think that's great advice to focus on developing that deep expertise, and you'll have a wonderful career. Other advice I've received and sometimes followed, but I think it's fabulous, is about networking. Everybody says network, network, network. It's the last thing on your list. You have so many other things to do once you're in your job. And
demands and deadlines and everything else, but networking is the most fabulous way to develop professionally, to hear about other opportunities, to just shake you out of your comfort zone, even when you're not looking for another job. It's always interesting to hear about what other people are doing, and every time I network, I go, oh, crap, I have there's all these other great jobs out there I ought to be doing, but I have this job, you know, and it's just so fascinating what other lawyers are doing, especially in the Washington area. But really anywhere, you run into just such interesting people doing really interesting things, and it really opens your eyes to what the possibilities are as a lawyer. And also, you know, even if you have a great job, maybe just for professional development reasons, it's good to make a change and try something different. And then the last piece of advice, which I haven't taken yet, but I suspect I will at some point in my career, is that, your career isn't a straight trajectory, that you should anticipate at points you're going to plateau and level off. And it's okay to take those times in your career. So if it's for having children or taking, you know, studying for an MBA or doing something else with your life, taking care of your elderly parents or whatever it is, that sometimes you get off the treadmill and just sort of stay where you are and do something for a couple of years, or maybe you get out of the workforce for a couple of years but then go back in. But that's okay, and I think law is a really flexible profession and allows you to do that. And you should anticipate that you don't always have to be looking to, like, what's the next move? I do my so many years at the law firm, then I go in-house or I go into the government and then I do this. And, you know, pushing. You know, I think about myself having, you know, another 30 years of work. And I can't imagine doing the job I have now for another 30 years. So I'm going to have some plateaus in there, and just pacing myself and accepting that that's what your career looks like, and that's okay, and that's actually a good thing. So being patient, I guess, with yourself and giving yourself time to explore and just do what it is you're doing instead of pushing for the next thing.
I guess I'll dispense with the advice not taken, because I'm a lot like Alex. I was too obtuse to even remember it, let alone follow it. I'm sure there was a lot of those. But the best advice I got actually was from a client who was a bit older than I was. He was the president of this startup company that I was representing. I was actually representing the Norwegian owner of it, and we hired this guy to be the CEO, and he was probably 15, 18 years older than I was at the time. And he had been very successful in terms of, he had a high-level government career and had done a lot of different things. But he was always smiling, and he was always, we traveled back and forth to Norway a lot, so we got to know each other well. And his philosophy was, and this is absolutely the best thing I've ever learned, he said, you have to take your job very, very seriously. Take your job seriously. And don't take yourself seriously at all. So you really need, we all get kind of wound up in what we're doing, and you know, if we identify ourselves with our job too much, we can be petty, we can, you know, have a chip on our shoulder, so. But if you can separate those two things out, and you are not your job, you are you, and your job is your job. Take your job seriously. Don't take yourself seriously. You'll do a much better job, and you'll have a lot more fun.
That's good advice. And on that note, I'll just open up any questions that you want to ask generally before we allow you to just come down here and chat. Well, thank you all for coming. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much to our panelists for agreeing to be here today. We really appreciate it.